Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is April 2nd, and I'm Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is the resurrection and the nature of life. It's spring, and where I live, everything is bursting out. It's quite beautiful. The rain comes, and then more blossoms. It's all of a sudden. This is also Easter, and Christians celebrate the resurrection of Jesus this weekend. I live in a Bible Belt farming community, so this is a big weekend for us. We celebrate the immortality of our souls. The priests and the Romans can control or destroy your physical body, and they can manipulate the crowd to turn against you for some period of time. However, they cannot change the truth, and they cannot kill our immortal intelligence and love. They do not have that power. And the message of the story of the resurrection is there are limits to their power. There is something much more powerful. And I always say the statue of Jesus dying on the cross in many, particularly Catholic churches, is a subliminal message from the priest saying, don't mess with our money. And the resurrection says, too bad, in the end, you cannot contain or control our intelligence and our love. One of my favorite scriptures is from Deuteronomy. I call heaven and earth as witness this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both you and your descendants may live. Every time we turn around these days, we're asked to choose death. Common core curriculum, vaccines, invasive software and media, entrainment technology, GMO food, unhealthy and expensive healthcare, $1.7 trillion in global military expenditures. The coming of spring and the resurrection reminds us we don't have to go along, and that we're dealing with leadership that is so fearful and so perverted that they're bound to fail because they bring death, they don't bring life. So we're called this weekend to restore our faith and our spirits so that we can continue to choose a world where we organize in alignment and in support of life. If we all simply choose life, then the things that bring death can never be implemented. Remember that, we have that power. Money and markets. I'm using the Wednesday close one day after the quarter close, just because I'm recording this week early due to the holidays. The DAX is the star performer, the Germany top 30 companies, up 23% so far as of the Wednesday close. U.S. dollar index is up about 8.7% this year. That's after being up 12.5% this year. So the dollar's on quite a tear. It's at 90, trading around 98 right now. It peaked at 100 and back down. But it seems to show a lot of strength. Developed markets up 6.23%. The 20-year plus Treasury ETF, TLT, up 4.93%. Emerging markets perked up particularly today, closing at 3.4%. Gold up 1.8%. The aggregate bond ETF up 1.3%, and the S&P, disappointing performance, flat, up a little bit today so that it could close flat. Thanks to the Fed's recent dovish position, U.S. bonds are outperforming U.S. equity. So let's just look at that again. The long Treasury ETF up 4.93%, the aggregate corporate bond up 1.3%, the S&P flat. There's no doubt that the U.S. dollar, a strong dollar, is hurting corporate profits, and that hurt is not over because the dollar could go much higher. I should point out if you look at the stocks on the S&P that have buyback programs, they're up about 2.5% for this same period, so the buyback stocks continue to outperform the general market. As I said, the hurt is not over. The dollar could go much higher. If you look at a list of corporate profits, the percent of corporate profits that come from or have foreign exposure, the average for the S&P is approximately 46%, almost half. The highest sector is information technology at 57%. So as I said, there's a lot more hurt that continue on corporate profits, and that means a struggle for the U.S. stock market. If you look at seasonal patterns, we're in a pre-election year. It should be strong, but let's see. Global stocks are doing well. The Wall Street Journal noticed today, and that's as a result of quantitative easing globally, at least 17 stock indices saw fresh highs in the first quarter, including the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and India. Some 20 more hit their highest level going back a year or more. So quantitative easing is no doubt is lifting the equity. As you can see from the blog and the site this week, debt is on my mind more than equity. When I first mentioned debt equity swaps about a year ago, I kept getting lots of questions. And so I decided it was time to drill down with you on both the debt equity system so that we could come back to the debt equity swap question with a lot more depth. Because if you get into the logistics of how debt to equity swaps may occur, whether they're formal or informal, it requires a sort of more drill down on the nuts and bolts. So in addition to our second part interview with Dr. Farrell this week on debt, there are two commentaries that I posted. One, how low can you go? The cumulative impact of falling interest rates. It was part inspired by a Swiss Re study, the leading insurance company on financial, or one of the leading Swiss insurance companies, a study on financial repression, which I've also put up on the website. You can find it introduced and linked there. There are three things happening, and they're part of the squeeze of the slow burn, and I describe them in the commentary, How Low Can You Go? One is low interest rates. If you go back and look at 1990, a $100,000 deposit would have earned about $8,000 to $9,000. In 2005, it would have earned about $5,000. In the last year, it earned maybe $300, $400. And so instead of making $40,000 over the last four or five years from a $100,000 bank deposit, a saver is earning $2,000. That's $38,000 short. That's a huge short. And you're seeing people who are not used to worrying about their budgets feeling very squeezed by this. So savers are getting really clocked. No wage growth productivity. I put up a little chart on the in the post that you can see. So we have getting no returns on our capital, no growth in wages as a result of increased productivity. So we're doing the work but not getting the benefit. And finally, you continue to see a rise in the cost of most essentials. There's been a little bit of a respite on gas, but if you look at the price of food and many other essentials, there's no doubt revenues are dropping. And expenses are rising, and that squeeze is now, it squeezed a lot of people, but it's now reaching people who are not used to that, sort of having to worry about the basics. Pension funds and insurance companies have now gone 5 years not getting a lot of yield as their portfolio rolls over, and that really hurts their ability to pay out benefits and to meet obligations under annuities, which is why I'm assuming we're starting to see the insurance industry do things like publish the study that Swiss Re did. The second commentary I wrote this weekend was a book review by a very interesting book by an anthropologist who's also a professor at the London School of Economics, David Graeber. It's called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Graeber really digs in and looks at the history of how transactions have supported trade and commerce, and ultimately arrives at a very similar place as I do, that debt is not a financial system, but a control system, and it has required many centuries of violence to get it to the point where it is now. He also points out that the central banking warfare model is running out of steam, but doesn't see the opportunity to increase wealth while reducing consumption. Everybody just assumes because we have to lower our environmental footprint, that means we all have to give up on growth or the growth of financial wealth, which is ridiculous. I don't think that's true at all. But it does mean we do have to shift to an equity model. I would note Senator Mario Rubio, who's making more and more noise these days, has a tax reform proposal that proposes for businesses to allow asset purchase to be expensed, and get ready for this, to eliminate interest deductions. That would be an exceptionally wonderful world, I think, but very, very interesting. But that would certainly help get you to an equity model. The Iran negotiations continue. The president has his hands quite full with a lot of difficult characters on all different sides of that. And that one's important, so stay tuned. Throughout the business section, you see the same story or the same theme over and over again. Back to basics all around the world, whether it's the global slowdown, the drop in commodities, or global tensions. Companies are pulling back and moving back into basics. couple of examples. Target and Best Buy move out of Canada. Fresh Market, my favorite market when I'm out in California, my favorite market here, is leaving California. Just went in a couple years ago and now suddenly decided, no, going back to the East. We're watching numerous, at the same time, heavily capitalized players moving in to buy resources cheap. I mentioned the other week, Exxon is buying up positions in Russia. But there's no doubt those with sitting on the sidelines with big cash have a real opportunity to buy up assets and resources cheap. The IPOs declined in the first quarter. The reports are in. There were 34 initial public offerings with proceeds of $5.4 billion. That's the smallest number in 2 years. Some of that is, in fact, the fact that large companies with cash are buying up the new companies. But I think part of it reflects this pulling back in and the sort of slowness that's hitting in all sides. It's a very interesting editorial this week from Andy Kessler, former hedge fund manager, saying the glory days of private equity are over. The buyout game has squeezed and flipped about everything that can be squeezed and flipped. So it's back to basic. He points out that very little of the private equity money is venture capital, which in fact increases productivity, and argues that a lot of the buyout and the leverage buyouts decrease productivity. Hear, hear. I hope he's right. I couldn't agree more. We're all going to have to get back to doing things that, instead of harvesting those who are productive, get back to doing things that increase real productivity. An interesting comment from the China Wealth Fund. They're focusing globally, they said, and more back to basics, real estate, infrastructure, food companies. You certainly see China moving to build infrastructure all around the world. It's part of the Asian Development Bank that they're promoting and is very much in the news. But interestingly enough, China said they're planning on investing a lot in the U.S., giving either a strong indication that they think the U.S. economy is going to continue strong, or they made the right deals behind the back door, and that's all part of them. But there's no doubt everyone across the markets is looking for companies or equities that can generate a yield during challenging times that have very enduring market shares or niches. Don't believe what you read about the German wing plane crash. The stories don't make any sense. You know, of course, we had the lone gunman, then we had the lone trader, now we have the lone pilot. There are several logical explanations for what happened. I have no idea what's true. However, the airline industry, I'm sure, would far prefer us to all believe the lone crazy pilot story than the idea that planes can be hijacked by the remote control systems and flown into mountains as part of a geopolitical squabble, which, of course, is one of the plausible options, I believe. I published, when the Fed came out with their comment, I published an article called What the Fed is Really Saying, which bounced quite around the internet. It was called An English Translation. I've done it several times when the Fed and the IMF announce, and just trying to help people understand what they're saying, the extent to which the comments make sense or really are political and don't have a logic in economics. Anyway, it seems to really be popular, so I'll try to do more of that so that some of those pronouncements can be more accessible. There's a great DVD video we put up on the blog called What If 3D Printing Was 100 Times Faster by a scientist in North Carolina who's come up with a 3D printer that works sort of bottom up and goes much faster. It was inspired by the creation of the character in Terminator. It's a great example of the speed of innovation, which is so dramatic right now. And what's interesting to me is I've taken several different clients and subscribers and said, look, I really want you to take the time to look at these different areas. In the third quarter wrap up, to remind you, I went through the different areas that are receiving lots of reinvestment so you could sort of drill down and see what's happening. But if you go in and look at the speed of the innovation, whenever I do this, they come back and say, oh my God, it's moving so much faster than I ever dreamed it was. And you know, the future's not coming, it's here. And the creative destruction potential is pretty wild. It's one of the reasons I think we're seeing more and more focus on real estate from a variety of different institutional and large investors. And that's because new technology lowers expenses, It can cause a lot of creative destruction, so a lot of companies to fail or incomes to drop, but it lowers expenses. It's very deflationary, and that can increase the value of real estate. So real estate can be a very safe place to be. And there's no doubt about it, given the sort of increased interest in food, real estate also includes farmland, which I think is going to continue to hold a lot of value, particularly farmland that has great water. Drought being a bigger and bigger issue. It's something I just finished doing an interview with Whitley Strieber, which we'll publish at the end of the month. And it's something Whitley and I talked a lot about is the California drought and how long the droughts could last. And I'm going to underscore this heads up. I had a commentary up week before last kickstarting the first time home buyer. I keep talking about all the different things the feds are doing to juice the homebuyer market. Now they're really facilitating a tremendous ease of terms for the vets. It's a wonderful thing, and I hope it makes it possible for as many vets as possible to buy homes. But you need to pay attention, because there's no doubt coming into a presidential election, the efforts are pretty significant to juice the housing market. What that means is if you're a renter and you can afford to take the risk and buy a home, and you're in a place where there's a lots of 3.0 and or foreign investment, you should probably take advantage of the low interest rates, but you don't want to get left out of the market if you eventually want to own your home. There are perfectly legitimate reasons not to own a home. I'll never forget one of the best presentations I saw was from a University of Maryland professor who pointed out that homeowners spend 20 hours a week taking care of their home that renters don't have to spend. So, as I said, there are many good reasons to not buy a home. But if you want to buy a home and your profile is one that can take the risk and you're in an area that's strong economically, if the feds really do what I think they're going to do, it could really you could really get priced out of the market. So keep an eye on that if it's appropriate for you. Our hero this week is WikiLeaks, who yet again dished out another part of the secret Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Thank God for WikiLeaks. At least there's some look and debate about this. It's pretty ugly. And then I'd like to also mention Swiss Re. For an insurance company to come out with something on financial repression and the implications is a real indication of the hurt that the insurance companies and pension funds are feeling in their investment portfolios as they look at their long-term obligations and see the extraordinary drop in investment returns they've gotten in their fixed income portfolios. Ask Catherine. Hi, Catherine. You mentioned on the recent Dark Journalist interview that you're planning a trip to the East Coast. Is that still in the works? If yes, are there any details you're ready to release about date, place, and time? Yeah, I should be arriving on the 18th in the Philadelphia area. I'm leaving on the 26th. We have lunch in New York with Richard Dolan. We've sent out invitations to most subscribers. If you're in the West Coast, you might not have gotten one because we figure there's no way you want to fly to New York, although you're certainly welcome. If you didn't get it, please check your spam filter or call or email customer service for the link where you can buy a ticket. We'd love to have as many of our East Coast subscribers, as many of our subscribers who can come. The ticket's a little bit more pricey, just we spent a lot of time looking for New York restaurants, and they were all expensive. So this is only designed to cover a portion of our cost. And I know it's tax season, so it's always hard to cough money up in April. But Richard's coming down from Rochester. It'll be a long four-hour time with him, a great time to interact and ask every question you've ever wanted to ask Richard Dolan and me. And these luncheons with that kind of time turn into great conversations. I know the people who are coming. It's a fabulous crowd. So I think those of you who can take the time to join us, that's a Saturday. It'll be very worthwhile, and you'll really enjoy the crowd. So I hope you come. A question that I'd read before about Dr. Farrell or other space program researchers know anything about meteorite events. I'm trying to get an answer to that, but I just don't know. One subscriber wrote in and recommended G. Edward Griffin, who's done marvelous work, both he's the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, the best book really on the creation of the Federal Reserve. He's done some marvelous work on cancer and cancer research. Griffin's one of my heroes. It's a great suggestion. I will definitely add him to my list. I'd love to have Griffin on. Then let's see, a great comment from a subscriber referring to the planet debt interview that we're doing with Farrell. Wow, can't wait for this interview. Would you discuss the possibility of a reset of the world's economy? With the global debt bubble, wouldn't it be better to just let everyone default and collapse, start off minus the socialism, Marxism? No, let's not hope we get a collapse, because what it means is one group of people will have an extraordinary amount of money and everybody else will be desperate. So that could make things much, much worse. Let the free market restore the terrible devastation the bankers have done. I assure you, collapse would not return us to free market, would return us to breakaway civilization tyranny. So, I think that collapse myth is very different. I will address some of this in the first quarter wrap up with when we focus on planet debt. So I'm very glad you asked those questions. A comment from the gentleman who encouraged me to read Meltdown in Tibet. I had mentioned a different article, and but take a look at Meltdown in Tibet, or do a search for Meltdown in Tibet. It's on the, let me just read one of the introductory descriptions. Tibetans have experienced waves of genocide since the 1950s. Now they are facing ecocide. It's true the Chinese are moving north and grabbing resources left and right, and it's a very difficult, bitter time for the Tibetans. In your opinion, how will the AIIB affect the world economies, if at all? I think that he's referring to the new Asian Development Bank. We just saw news this week that Israel is now talking about joining. We've had a wave of European members join. And part of that was inspired by China's agreement that it wouldn't insist on a veto. I think that an Asian Development Bank is a terrific idea. It's going to facilitate the rebalancing of the global economy. If you haven't read the annual wrap-up this year, I really encourage you to do so. You can get it in many different forms. It's in flipbook form. We have a web presentation form, the audio form, the transcript. And, of course, if you want it in hard copy, we have an offering where you can buy the book. So it's but we talk a lot about the rebalancing. I think anything that will provide liquidity, particularly that's focused not on financial speculation, but in building really important infrastructure out and along the Silk Road, which I think the Asian Development Bank will probably be focused on, whether it's roads, whether it's bridges, whether it's high-speed rail. I think these are all things that can really build out a better world. So I think it's great, and yes, I think it can make a difference, and it's going to be very important, because every little ounce of liquidity is going to be needed if we get a very big, strong dollar scenario, which I'm afraid we might. The other thing is, it's a way of building cooperation globally. For too long, we've gone through some of these other structures like the IMF, and it's really weakened the cooperation muscle, if you will, of different countries vis-a-vis each other around the world. So I think the more we see these kinds of hard dollar cooperations between a variety of different players, I think it's really good. And I commend China for not insisting on a veto. Dear Catherine, you mentioned during your interview with Richard Dolan that U.S. financial entities have been issuing 10 mortgages per individual home on a large scale. Can you explain the process of how this was done and tell us who was paying the interest on all these loans? I can only guess. This is based on what I observe cleaning up financial fraud at FHA and HUD twice, and then from talking to people who claim to have been fraudsters who were doing that kind of fraud for the intelligence agencies. As I've always said, these things are a little bit like the joy of cooking. There are many recipes, but here's my guess from what I saw. I think they were taking the same house and putting multiple mortgages on it and defaulting it many times. So I remember finding one house in the Chicago interview which had defaulted 5 times in 1 year. I assure you can't do that in legitimate deals. Each time as they defaulted, they pulled money out of the FHA fund when the mortgage insurance got paid off. And that siphoned off the premiums from the mortgage, the mutual mortgage insurance fund, which is supposed to be a mutual which pays the sort of the profits in a book of business back to the insurance holders. And I think it siphoned off that money. And when you get the multiple defaults, those defaults are used to keep the pool going. And that's how you pay the, you keep the mortgages going. Say you do 10 mortgages on one house, you put it in a pool with a Ginnie Mae guarantee or a Freddie and Fannie guarantee. I think some of them ended up at Freddie and Fannie. And you just have multiple defaults to keep the interest coming. At some point, the pyramid collapses, which is why I think you get into these 2008 situations or the situation we got into in 1989, where you just get big collapses and big payouts. But if you've heard me tell the story of being at FHA and getting an inventory that said we had 10 homes on a block and getting to that block and there was, you know, there was an empty lot. And I think that's how you get those situations where you get many, many mortgages with either a limited amount of collateral or no collateral behind it. And you go through sort of churning of defaults to pull money out of the fund to pay for the mortgage pools. You can only do that with the New York banks who are servicing the portfolios going along with the game. Catherine, we know there's been much manipulation from behind the scenes to hold the price of gold down. Is there any reason why the powers that be could ever want the price of gold to rise substantially? Yes, of course, absolutely. I think it's really important to understand that it is impossible to tell what the real market price would be if we had transparency around inventories as well as the sources and uses of demand of gold. So I think it's important to remember that. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for the copy of the Salier Report 2015 with a personal note. This is from one of the people who came to our workshop. We sent the Salier Reports to, copies of the annual wrap-up to all of them. I've been reading Martin Armstrong's site for a while and just signed up for his conference. I'm curious about your take on his call for corporate restructuring of debt, canceling taxes, etc. There's no doubt restructuring of the debt system is coming. You have too many sovereign nations who are in real trouble and can't possibly meet their debt obligations. You have a real squeeze between the retirement demands of the population or expectations and the ability of the governments to keep the game going with issuing more and more debt. So we're definitely coming in for restructuring. I started talking a year ago about debt for equity swaps. Martin is as well. And here's the simple, short answer. Debt for equity typically means you get them over the barrel by getting them in too much debt, and then you can pick up their equity for cheap. It's what happened in 1997 with the East Asia sort of liquidity crunch. Suddenly, all the big Western investors, the whole Anglo-American Alliance was there with checkbooks trying to buy up big chunks of equity for cheap, the kind of equity they would never be allowed to buy. That's what we see in Greece. Part of the workout is they're saying, well, you can't pay back the debt, so now we want to buy all your companies for cheap. And the Germans are, the Greeks are saying, no, 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 no. You know, we're not going to let you buy the family heirlooms for cheap. So a couple more questions about Armstrong and his work. I think Armstrong is interesting, but he very much believes in black boxes and the ability to forecast. I think it's very dangerous to fall prey to that. I think we need a way of going about investment that doesn't depend on forecasting the future, because I think you can get yourself in quite a box. I think, you know, there's a lot, they point out that Armstrong doesn't look at the breakaway civilization or talk about black budgets. I think that's important. We really need to understand why the people in charge are so afraid and what they are afraid of. I mean, when you demand complete invasive 24/7 surveillance of adults and children, that's very, very invasive. So I think it is essential for any of our analysis that we look at those things and deal with the uncertainty of them. They point out he had a solutions conference. They just finished watching a three-hour tape. If anybody wants to send it to me, I'll watch it, because it is time we started talking about solutions at a more global level. And I think the BRIC nations and the development of the Asian the Asian Development Bank is sort of inspiring the conversation. Let's go to the movies. I put up for Let's Go to the Movies just a fascinating little documentary called Finding Vivian Maier, about one of the world's or the 20th century's greatest photographers who no one ever heard of or knew a peep about until after her death. Her photographs remained hidden and anonymous until after she died, and a young gentleman bought them at auction for, I think it was about $350. Anyway, the moral of the story is life is full of incredible surprises. You never know what might happen if you go to an auction and for $350 buy a suitcase and discover one of the greatest photographers of the 20th century. Quite amazing. Our interview is with Dr. Farrell. Dr. Farrell and I continue our discussion of debt and get very deeply into the relationship between war and debt. If you look at how much money we're spending on war, it's very much correlates to the amount of debt we're issuing. And at some point, it's very clear that we can't, you know, at this point, we cannot afford war anymore. It's just, it's too dysfunctional, it's too expensive, it's too harmful, and the debt system can't carry it anymore. So when you talk about restructuring debt, you're also talking about restructuring fundamental governance and how we manage geopolitics. So we're coming into we've never quite been at this place as a human race to have this many people and this many powerful people with this many powerful weapons having to literally reinvent the entire investment model that has been running planet Earth for 500 years. So it's quite an interesting time. Events, as I said, hold that date. Richard Dolan is going to be joining me for 4 hours at the 21 Club for lunch and rich discussion with you in New York, Saturday, April 25th. And if you haven't received your invitation and want one, first check your spam filter, but definitely email or call the customer service because we'd love to have you there. We have our silver coin promotion back again. Check out the homepage if you want a Solari coin. There's a way for you to do it. Coming up next week, I asked John Rappaport to come back and talk a little bit about imagination. My continual study into Common Core realized, oh God, they're trying to tear down imaginations even more. So it's very important to me that you have tools to build it up. And I love how John addresses that. Ann Williamson was with us last year to talk about what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. She's been over in Europe, and she's in Budapest now. And I asked her if she would come back and give us an update on what's going on, because I think it's so important to the entire geopolitical scene, and Anne's insight is remarkable. And then finally, the first quarter wrap-up on April 23rd, our big theme for the first quarter is going to be planet debt, and so I'm going to continue this conversation of debt through then. And then the following week, Whitley Strieber is going to be joining me for the big picture. That was a great and fascinating conversation. So until April 9th, have a wonderful Easter weekend. And I hope you are restored and rejuvenated. And while you're at it, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.